Today on Maine Calling, how people justify inequality. Throughout human history, there have been haves and have-nots, those who are wealthy and those who struggle to survive. But by many measures, that inequality is greater today than ever before, and the wealth gap is growing. Bates College sociology professor Francesco Duina has been thinking about the cultural acceptance of this phenomenon and how people justify inequality. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with Duina about his new book, The Social Acceptance of Inequality, on the logics of a more unequal world. He and his co-editor gathered analysis and insights from experts around the world for their perspective. They find that people have all kinds of rationales, from economic to moral, for accepting the world we live in. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Many people feel disturbed by the massive income inequality in our world, but others accept it. Why? Bates College sociology professor Francesco Duina examines this question in his new book, The Social Acceptance of Inequality, on the Logics of a More Unequal World. Duina has written and edited numerous books, including Why Poor Americans Love Their Country, and that's book we discussed on Maine Calling in 2017. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you believe that there will always be a gap between the rich and poor? Is this just a natural part of the world? Or can it be changed? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Professor Duina, welcome back to Maine Calling.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, right now, many people are talking about the reasons for the great wealth inequality in our world, and others who view it as a problem are working to try to figure out solutions. But you chose to look at something different, the logics or the justification that people have behind this wealth inequality. Why? Why did you decide to look at it through this lens?
Well, thank you. Thank you again for having me. I guess part of the reason for the choice is that it's related to the first two things. The logics or the justifications are drivers of these inequalities. So if we want to understand where they come from or why they're sustained, we want to understand why some people are okay with them. And I guess the second part is of the answer is that a surprisingly a diverse number of people support or to varying degrees inequalities. And we're talking specifically about economic inequalities here. So inequalities of wealth or income. So
it's
we're driven by this positive. Yeah.
I suspect that people sometimes, if they're asked outright, do you support income inequality, might have a different answer than the answer when you start to dig down. And I know that you kind of do this experiment with your students. Tell me about the question and how it's at first perceived, but then when people start to think about it, what you find.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question of degrees as well, right? But most people, I think, would say if you ask them, are you okay with enormous inequalities? Most people would probably say no, though some people will say, absolutely, I'm completely comfortable for whatever reasons. But it's also true that as I, investigate with my students and I kind of challenge them, it's also true that most people don't want perfect equality either. And so then the question is, at what point do people become uncomfortable and at what point do they continue to accept income inequalities? But as I said, depending on the context, country, set of people and mix, some people are quite comfortable with rising inequalities. And so, that's kind of the focus of the group, of the book, the volume. Yeah.
Yeah, you have people, experts from around the world, with their analysis, their perspective. Fascinating. And I'm wondering if in different parts of the world, people feel differently about the concept of income inequality.
Yeah, that's one of the motivating factors actually of the volume is that there are inequalities manifest themselves very differently in different places. So to make it to give you an easy example to work with, if you come from a country that where there was great poverty for everybody, say 30 years ago, and now you're seeing extensive inequalities, people may be more okay with that because they compare the current situation with a time when everybody was poor, and naturally they say, well, it's okay if there are great inequalities, and even if they themselves are not directly benefiting from the inequalities, they imagine that one day they will. So there are various, and we can talk about the four types of logics or justifications that we're going to use. But so absolutely, so if you are, by contrast, say in a Scandinavian country where equality has been a sort of a goal of society in many different ways, or low inequality, then you might interpret great inequalities with more suspicion. Though, as one of our ch chapters shows, actually, in some of the Scandinavian countries, there is an increased interest in more inequality, and I can prefer happy to discuss that as an example if you want.
Sure, we'll dig in just a second. And I'm just wondering though, as you think about this issue, as you research it, as you read the essays and analyses of your colleagues, do you find that there are some overriding concepts that people often agree with? And I'm guessing that one concept that there might be a lot of agreement on is this whole value of meritocracy.
Right. So you're kind of putting your finger on one of the justifications. So again, I would caveat that with even the same words, however translated in different languages or concepts, when said in different contexts, mean different things. So for example, I deserve it. When you say that in the UK, maybe you mean something a little bit different than when you say it in, say, Vietnam. With that said, yes, we identify effectively four major types of justifications. The first one, then let's talk about the first one that you discussed, is the more what we call moral justifications. Those are justifications which essentially rely on a perception of inequalities as fair, as correct, as the right outcome. And indeed, for that, inequalities therefore are actually desired. You want to see them. There's something inherently valuable about them.
And I'm
The other
thinking that there's like these are sort of deep human values. These aren't just reflecting our times today. As you say this, I'm thinking about Aesop's fables and the industrious animals versus the animals that are not. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. These are deeply held logics. They're not superficial logics in a sense. They're there because lots of people believe in them and have believed in them in one way or another, or they're pulling from certain cultural threads, if you will, that have been around for a long time. And that's why I also think it's important to recognize that they may vary a great deal, even if the words are the same. So the other three logics that each of them probably sound familiar to some extent to our listeners. The second one would be say a market or economic logic, and that's the logic, the justifications that say, well, if we're going to have a dynamic, innovative, creative economic system, as with capitalism, one perhaps undesired outcome could be arising in the existence of inequalities, and we tolerate them, we accept them. These kinds of logics, I should add, do not necessarily celebrate inequalities in the same way that the moral ones do, but they view inequalities as sort of inevitable outcomes of the process. So the third type is group and ethnic logics, and those are logics that state essentially that a particular group or ethnicity or some group based on ethnicity, gender, whatever race, class even, is more entitled by virtue of who they are, including, say, citizenship. So this group is, by virtue of who they are, more entitled. Perhaps the cleanest example is the caste system in India. I'm a Brahmin, therefore I'm entitled to more by virtue of the fact of who I am. And these inequalities, you know, associate, these justifications associate the inequalities with ideas of belonging and natural hierarchies. And the fourth is basically a more, what we call an institutional cultural justification. And that is that there might be something in the broader environment that makes these inequalities more acceptable. A classic example or typical example, a good example could be the American dream. If you grew up in the United States, you're surrounded by the myth of the American dream, and therefore you're more likely to accept inequalities because it goes well with that myth, right? You grew up in an environment where these sorts of things are accepted, and therefore you also accept particular manifestations of them.
Do you find that people who are well off are more likely to accept social inequality, economic inequality, than people who are not?
Another wonderful question that we grappled with. We were motivated largely by the answer being no, and we have data to show that. It isn't just a matter of the rich or the better off feeling entitled or feeling like they subscribe to these logics, but in fact, many people along the spectrum, the economic spectrum, embrace or accept these inequalities and embrace these logics. So that's a very important point, because it isn't just a stratified, if you will, kind of acceptance, but it's a widespread acceptance at different levels across different groups. And so that made it all the more intriguing, right? We want to know why and how these logics are embraced and held up by different people, you know, in different countries and in different settings and in different ways. And we can talk about some examples that I think will bring it to life.
I want to ask you, do you find that many people have sort of an internal tipping point in which inequality is okay to them until some point? But when they read that, for example, the richest 26 people in the world own as much wealth as the bottom 50% of the world, that's shocking and that's not okay. You know, it's okay that some families can afford to go to college and some families can't, in their view. But this where we've gotten today is not okay, or whatever somebody's calculation is. It's okay that some people inherit money and some people don't, but where we are today is too far.
Yeah, so I think so. I think there are tipping points. Certainly, the size of the inequality, which is what we deal with in this volume, and my contributors, all of them were asked to think about, you know, large inequalities, not just small inequalities. So the question is, how do people justify those? So of course, the bigger the inequalities, I think that might make a difference. I also think that a tipping point might be a moment when the adverse consequences of the inequalities manifest themselves. So it's okay if somebody gets rich as long as it doesn't affect negatively lots and lots of people. But when we can show that it does, maybe that's a tipping point. I also have to say, though, that many people are very generous with themselves, and they're, you know, if it's about themselves, they may be more tolerant than about others. So one of our chapters deals with inherited property in London. And the authors there show that people who inherited wealth, particularly real estate in this case, are very, very good at justifying why they are morally entitled to their inheritance and accepting being suddenly thrown into a higher echelon of wealth. And they're quite good at that. And perhaps they wouldn't be as comfortable following the same logic if it came to somebody else. But they're quite good at that, and they've effectively find ways of justifying why they're entitled. And when I talk about this, for instance, in the recent months when we talked about this volume, everybody kind of smiles and says, oh, not me. But I challenge every listener today, if you inherited something, don't you think you deserve it more than the random person walking by you? If the answer is no, I'd like to know the thinking, because most people would say, well, I mean, I think it belongs to me more than to some random person. So what is the logic of that, you know? Yeah.
We'll go to Richard, who's calling from Rollinsford, New Hampshire. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Good morning. Hi. This is a very interesting subject. I just the idea of wealth inequality is a term of socialism that is really, I think, very damaging to society, because the idea of percentages of wealth owned by certain percentages of people. Wealth is fluctuates every day. Between its fortunes are won and lost every day, and also the idea of corralling it into the term of capitalism is incorrect. That's a Marxist term. The term properly is mercantilism, being someone who is industrious, mercantile, rather than capitalistic. And the whole notion of this is you know, that your guest is calling the American dream a myth, which is really, really offensive. And I just want to say that.
So Richard, is what Richard is thinking, is this what you're writing about, Francesco?
Well, okay, so a couple of things, I guess. One is, I mean, when we say the American dream is a myth, it doesn't mean that it's not real. It's also a myth in that people believe in it, face value. So that's kind of how we use it in one of the chapters. But I would also say that the most recent data shows that intergenerational mobility in the United States has stagnated over the last decade or two decades. That is to say, if you're born poor in the United States, you're very likely to stay poor, much more likely than used to be the case. And similarly, if you're born rich, you're very likely to stay rich, much more so than before. But let's talk about the myth that the American dream is not really a thing as much as it used to be. And in fact, there is more intergenerational mobility in what Richard calls, or maybe I would call, a more socialist oriented country. For instance, in Denmark, there is more intergenerational mobility there than there is here. So I think there is some ground to argue that the American dream is a myth because it's not really real anymore. Though it is, even if it were real, I would submit it's still a myth. It's still a belief, you know, in a sense, but that's nuances.
And when we talk about wealth, it's easy to talk about ownership and money and economics, but you're actually kind of talking about something even more, correct? You're talking about citizenship and quality of life, correct?
In this book, really, we are focusing on two measures of income, of economic inequality, and those would be income inequality and wealth inequalities. And so we try to stay as focused as we can on that. We do, however, recognize throughout that those kinds of inequalities intersect with other kinds of inequalities often. So it's a little hard to talk strictly about income inequalities without running into other kinds of inequalities, because they're often intertwined. But actually, that's relevant as well for our specific focus, because sometimes the other kinds of inequalities are the basis for why we accept the income inequalities. That is to say, for example, I belong to this particular group, therefore I'm of a higher standing, and therefore I'm entitled to more. Yeah. For whatever reason, we can debate it. So, for example, I am I'm a Danish citizen. I'm entitled to welfare benefits as a result of that. If that makes me better off than an immigrant in Denmark, that's perfectly fine. That's how it should be. So differences in social standing can be drivers of differences in acceptance levels of inequalities in economic terms, if that makes sense. Sorry to be so complicated, but...
Richard, thank you so much for calling in. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We are talking about a new book edited by our guest, Francesco Duina. It is The Social Acceptance of Inequality. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about the themes of a new book that examines inequality of income and wealth and how society thinks about it. My guest today, Francesco Duina, he teaches sociology at Bates College. He's written and edited several books. His latest is The Social Acceptance of Inequality on the Logics of a More Unequal World. Share your comments and questions. You can send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Mark Dixon, who is one of the contributors to the book we're discussing. He's a professor of sociology at Dartmouth College. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
the chapter that you contributed looks at this question of why people accept inequality through the lens of the American labor movement and unions. So my question to you, how have unions contributed to this way of thinking? Aren't they supposed to be egalitarian?
For sure. And you know, through the mid-20th century up into the late 20th century, unions were really a key equalizing force in the labor market and certainly in expressing more egalitarian views expressing the need to combat inequality. But they sort of fell off the map in the 1980s and 1990s. So we see really steep union decline during this period. And what I argue that beyond the numbers, unions as an institution, as an actor, sort of undermined their egalitarian emphasis and indirectly contributed to this acceptance of inequality through some of the practices when they're just trying to survive during the 80s and 90s.
So what kind of practices do you mean?
Yeah, so as the economy is kind of cratering in the early 80s, there's a big recession, especially in manufacturing. Many unions start engaging in concessionary bargaining as an attempt to save jobs and avoid plant closures. And so giving money back, essentially. And in some ways, this was certainly a necessary element. But as the economy improves, employers are still asking for more and unions are still giving it. And so one of the reasons why labor, was an effective advocate for equality is because, workers saw them as effective bargaining agents. They could help them in their jobs, and that individuals in the greater public saw them as, mostly advancing the greater good. And in the 80s and 90s, this starts to change a little bit. So they lose their sway in bargaining. As another attempt to save jobs, they agree to so-called two-tiered bargaining. And so this means, in an attempt to lower the wage bill for employers, unions would say any new members who join the union will come in at a lower rate. And meanwhile, these older members can stay at a higher rate. So they're introducing inequality into their own organizations at this point and sort of undermining their their face as an agent for equality.
Mm. And here we are in 2025. Do you believe attitudes are changing within unions and the general public?
Yeah, a little bit. So during this period of decline, one thing that happens is the general public sours on unions a little bit, too. So you see public approval of unions heading downwards during this period. Confidence in unions is another question, pollsters ask. That also sees a dip during these years. And that's changed a little bit since then. And I would say that workers and unions, especially since right on the heels of the COVID pandemic, have pushed back a little bit. And so I just mentioned two-tiered bargaining. That came up as a flashpoint in recent strikes and has been reversed in some collective bargaining contracts, such as like the auto worker strike that happened a couple years ago. And as this stuff is happening, public approval of labor unions has actually gone up. And so it's closer to what it was in the early post-World War II years than during the 80s and 90s. So there have been some changes.
Mm. Do you believe that the changes and the changes of attitude are, what's the word I'm looking for, practical? Are they, or do you believe people are thinking deeply about the questions that are being thought about in this book about, what are we accepting and what is equality?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I don't have one answer. So the multiple answers are people are concerned about their daily existence and how unions or anyone can help them navigate their job and improve that. But the more unions are able to do that and be an effective voice for workers on the job, the more people start to think about inequality and see labor as potentially a source to address it. And so I think some of those changes are afloat. One problem is that, for unions to be effective, they need to be seen as someone who's advancing the greater good. And there's so much contention over what the greater good is right now since we live in a very polarized environment. So there's a lot of challenges.
Yeah, Mark, thank you so much for calling in. Mark Dixon, Dartmouth College professor of sociology and a contributor to the book, The Social Acceptance of Inequality. Francesco, I think there's a new book for you. Your next book is What is the Greater Good? How about that?
Oh.
Joining us now is Megan Tobias Neely. She is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, also a contributor to this book. Megan, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for having me and having this conversation about this topic.
Yeah, well, you examine this question through the world of tech and finance, and this is a world where people take great risks, and some are very, very wealthy. How do people in this world think about inequality, or do they?
Yeah, I think, well, what I find, so I focus on both tech and finance and look at particularly high earning and high capital generating industries. So people who work in hedge funds, venture capital, private equity, and technology startups. And generally speaking, it is that piece of risk taking that you mentioned that helps them to kind of justify the high earnings. And the idea is that, you know, in their, with this mindset, they think that those who put their jobs and money on the line to take risks in the stock market or by starting an entrepreneurial venture, that they deserve and have earned this higher income than people who play it safe in a secure job.
Yeah, and this is not a new way of thinking. I looked it up to find out who is the person who's credited with saying the greater the risk, the greater the reward. And I think it's Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it really captures the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that's kind of at the heart of the American dream and this idea that that we are a society that takes risks and that is what spurs the economy. And one of the things I found kind of fascinating, too, is that on the research on entrepreneurship, it actually finds that in a lot of European countries, there are higher rates of entrepreneurship because there are social safety nets to catch people when those risks fail. So if you have, you know, universal health care or job security unemployment benefits that can allow you to take those risks, it actually benefits or spurs that spirit and entrepreneurialism even more than in our system where we have fewer relative safety nets.
Do the people that you study, these people who are in the world of tech and finance where there is a lot of money, do they believe that they are making the world a better place? And if so, what's their logic?
Absolutely. I mean, with my interviews with people in finance, especially at hedge funds, they really think of themselves as investing the money for institutions and securing our future. So the way they gain meaning in their work is by thinking about, you know, the pension fund that invests in their hedge fund or the university endowment. And they take pride in building that solid foundation that supports society. And they think of themselves as investing in ways that makes market more efficient. So through kind of a capitalist logic, they understand themselves as helping to make companies sort of more efficient or effective. And they think that can help create jobs. But they were also, in that particular group, I was amazed by how critical they were, though, of this mindset. So they both embraced that sort of notion of whose interests they served, but they also thought that the system was inefficient. So they thought there were too many fees charged. These were often people employed at hedge funds that didn't have control over the fee model. So they thought that there would be ways that could make it more equitable so that they support the people they want to serve better.
Well, Megan, thanks so much for calling in and joining the conversation. Megan Tobias Neely is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and she wrote one of the chapters in the book that we're discussing, The Social Acceptance of Inequality. Let's go to some more callers. We'll go to Annabelle calling from Waterville. Hi, Annabelle. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yeah, so here in Central Maine, I work as a mental health crisis responder, and something we see a lot is income inequalities and this lack of wealth causing, you know, inability to access basic health care, whether that's mental and physical. And I was wondering if you could speak to how, you know, these disparities cause in America generational lack of access to basic necessities and drives people to further poverty and unhealth.
Francesco.
Yeah, great. Thanks for calling. And that's a great question. I would say that that's slightly outside of the purview of the volume. We don't really look at necessarily these adverse reinforcing cycles as such. But certainly, I think, obviously, you're pointing to something very important, that there is an outcome almost of the inequalities that we tend to accept, or at least some of them. And then once they're launched, if you will, or exist, they have impacts and effects that, unless targeted targeted through policy, as Megan was saying, for example, they continue to exist, you know. This reminds me of another thing I meant to mention earlier, and that is, in essence, the ways in which the sort of tangential to this point, but I think relevant, is the way in which the logics themselves work. And by the way, I should say that neither myself nor my co-editor, Luca Storti, who also co-edited the book, he's at the University of Torino in Italy. We are agnostic about these logics. We don't take positions. We don't seek to criticize them or not. We seek to understand them. And I think even from Mark and Megan's conversations, you can see that there are things that are reasonable being said about these logics. So it's really a question of understanding how they work and how they manifest themselves. But there is a moment when we do pause and think about whether these logics have certain inherent features that make them faulty, if you will, particularly if you're interested in reducing inequalities. Perhaps you can go after the logics if they have a problem, right? The logics that support these inequalities. One of them that I think a lot of our readers, our listeners will find interesting is this loop. Is if you believe in merit, to start off with, Jennifer, your earlier point, if you believe in merit, you're actually less likely to objectively perceive of the existing inequalities out there. You're actually more likely to miss them. That's point number one. Point number two, if you don't observe that many inequalities out there, you're actually more likely to believe in merit as a fair mechanism for the creation of these inequalities. You say, well, if they exist, it must be because people kind of deserve what they get. There aren't that many anyway. Well, that's a loop, right? The less you see, the more you believe in merit, the less you see them, the less you see them, the more you believe in merit. And ultimately, that leads you to a world of, you know, segmented in your own world that has perhaps very little to do with the reality of the world out there. So there are some ways in which these things, again, these cycles, per the previous caller, reinforce themselves. So this is an example of a logic cycle.
Annabelle, thanks for calling in.
Thanks,
Annabelle. An email here from Steve. People don't realize the scale of the current inequality. Elon Musk's net worth is 1 million times that of a median Maine family's. So where a typical Mainer might put a dollar in a tip jar at a coffee shop, Musk could afford to drop $10,100 bills, $1 million. Musk's $227 million donation to Trump's campaign decreased his net worth as much as a typical Mainer making a $250 political donation. Francesco, is the scale the reason you decided to tackle this concept?
Yes, and Steve was the person who wrote, right, the message.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. We do believe that people do not fully realize the scale. There are some statistics that we show up front that are rather, I don't know, surprising probably to most people. So that's one thing, per my previous comment. They don't quite understand the scale. So we did write about that, and was one of our motivating factors and drivers is that in fact, you know, the scale is realizable. Another one of our findings is the closer you are to inequalities, the Annabelle, for instance, you know, the more you perceive it accurately, the more removed you are from them. And it's just an abstract notion that you read by going on the news, in the news, and reading newspapers or things like that. The less likely you are to actually dwell on them and actually perceive them accurately. So most of us have inaccurate perceptions of the levels of inequalities that are out there, for sure, and as well as the degree to which they have increased over time. Yeah, so then, you know, we live with them and don't quite understand. The other thing I would just add, though, on that is most people, even if they accept inequalities, something that we point out in the volume, it's not clear how prevalent that acceptance is in their minds. Sure, there are some that are enthusiastically for them, but most people walk around, they don't go around thinking, oh, do I accept inequalities or not, or how enthusiastic am I about these things? So one of the things we point out is the level of prominence in their minds or enthusiasm in their minds. And there's a full spectrum in the things that we look at.
Right, and there's a reason you use the word acceptance, that there may be many, many people out there who just think, well, that's just the way it is.
So that would be the fifth logic, Jennifer, that's fatalism. And we were almost going to have a whole section of chapters on fatalism. Well, that's the way it is. But we didn't, because in the end, that logic falls nicely into the others often. Why? Well, because of meritocracy, or because of the way the economic system works. So it's a subset almost. Right. At the same time, if you were to read the volume, we say the acceptance or approval, or even approval, because there are people who, of course, approve of this wholeheartedly, want even more, or actually search for more. In fact, if we have time later, maybe I can give you an example from Finland, where they did away with the wealth tax. In Finland, one of our chapters shows that the Finnish parliament decided to do away with one of the mechanisms that creates equality, more equality in Finland, and that is taxing wealth every year. And they actually chose to do away with a very historically present wealth tax. So they chose to create more inequality in Finland. And we're all puzzled by that. We're like, why is that? And the chapter shows that the logic there was that they did want to create more, to keep the wealthy wealthy. And that's because they were really worried about foreigners buying Finnish assets in Finland, factories and companies and buildings. And they thought, we either will become Chinese and Russian owned, or we can keep it Finnish, but we have to let our rich Finns keep their money therefore. So this is an example of one of our chapters of the complications, right? So it's a group-driven acceptance, in a say, of inequality within the group, because the group wants to protect itself from other groups. And it, however, then leads to a generation of more income, economic inequality as a result.
As though a ranking of values too, that one of our values is equality, but maybe a more important value is to keep, as many companies as possible Finnish owned.
Correct. So, and that's one of the things we see in many of the chapters, is that these logics are never held in abstract by themselves. They're always in relation to something, right? You can say, well, we could have more equality, but at what cost? Or we're going to have more inequality because we want something that on the face of it is not that related to inequality. That is, I don't want Russian, rich capitalists or oligarchs owning part of our cities, entire blocks. And, it's a choice. And so the embrace of inequality isn't necessarily, this is fantastic, but rather it's a way of doing away with a problem, with another problem. You put them on a scale and you say, I choose this over that. And so it's an acceptance, not necessarily an embrace in this case.
Well, we are talking with Professor Francesco Duina about the new book he co-edited, The Social Acceptance of Inequality. Join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our discussion today focuses on income and wealth inequality. And while some people accept this, and others do not, my guest today, Bates Professor Francesco Duina, he is editor of the new book, The Social Acceptance of Inequality, The Logics of a More Unequal World. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll go to Stephanie, calling from South Portland. Hi, Stephanie. Go ahead.
Hi. Just getting my phone off the speaker. I was, I'm just responding to an earlier caller, Richard, who was offended by Francesco or the authors, characterizing the American dream as a myth. And I don't think he's taking into account that it's drastically changed since the term was even coined due to, everything, like what's happened to the tax codes, what's happened to, through globalization with jobs being shipped overseas, corporate monopolies, stagnant wages, the stock market, the huge cost of higher education, the knock-on effects of super PACs and corporations supporting campaigns to affect legislation. It's almost made it impossible for the average guy.
Francesco.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I mean, I think that I would concur with that observation. And I go back to the data. The data show that intergenerational mobility is perhaps at its, well, not its lowest ever, but it's at a very low level right now in the United States. If you're born poor, you're going to stay poor. And I think the essential ingredient of the American dream is mobility. if we don't have, but then if we don't have a whole lot of mobility, and by the way, we have comparatively less mobility than in a lot of other places, then things have shifted indeed. I mean, I'm not saying you can't make it in the United States. I'm a migrant here myself, and it's a great place. But, you know, is it still the land of the American dream? I think it's questionable, at least for now.
Stephanie, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We'll go to Lee calling from Falmouth. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks. Hi. I wanted to mention that I think we're doing a lot of good things here in Maine to try to help people into careers that can move them out of that inequality gap. For example, we have Maine Care. We have free or reduced tuition at technical schools in the state, community colleges. And I think there's such a demand for people with skills such as plumbers, electricians, and so on. And we need those people. Now, some people might not have those skills, those abilities to do those technical jobs, but we can get them into other fields. And we need to start doing a better job encouraging students in high school to go into those fields. And by doing that, we're going to reduce that inequality gap. And the people that are left behind, we need to concentrate on them, find out what the cause is, and get them into the proper jobs and support them. But I think we can do better than we are, but we're going in the right direction. We just need to focus on getting those people into those areas, and that will help.
Lee, thanks for your call. Francesco, a little outside the scope of the book, but I know you live in Maine. You've written a lot about poverty. What do you think about Lee's observation?
I agree with that as well. And I think that Maine does a lot of things well in that regard. It's attentive to these matters. I would also say that walking back a little bit, what I said before, I know that in the United States, wages in the lower income level have been going up in the last few years. So there may be actually a decrease of inequality within the income spectrum within the United States. So maybe a reversal of the trend that we've been seeing. I would also say that there's a reversal of the trend between countries. Income level differentials between countries has been shrinking as China and India and other Vietnam and other places have become richer. So it's not just growing everywhere. And I would concur that in some states, and Maine being one of them, there are excellent programs that offer opportunities for sure. And so no doubt about that.
Lee, thank you so much for your call. Francesca, do men and women view income inequality differently and how they feel about it?
Yeah, so that's the question of gender, and that we use that in our book as a variable, if you will, social scientifically speaking. We do observe that there are differences across gender, you know, in terms of subscribing to these logics, but they're not necessarily highly pronounced. They're less pronounced than you would think. Though, for example, a chapter that is pretty quantitative and across 29 countries shows that there is, you know, if there's a typical group that is more positively oriented towards acceptance to some degree, is, are you ready? Male, high income, younger, postgraduates. So actually more education may actually lead you to accept more inequality than otherwise, but the male part is a relevant dimension. I'd also say, though, that the gender question brings up another dimension of the dynamic, and that is on the receiving end. So we see that when, in one chapter, for instance, on Latin America and migrants in Latin America, particularly women and young girls and young women migrating across Latin America in search for or escaping from things, that chapter unfortunately shows that there is a lot more tolerance of inequality towards them than there would be if they were male migrants. So there is a discriminatory quality that encourages people to accept more inequality when it comes to, well, if it's women, if it's girls, then we are more tolerant of the situation in which they find themselves. So that's a very disturbing chapter. And, you know, the author looks into that and how it is and how it can be fixed. And if it can be fixed, because even the solutions sometimes have bias components that that replicate some of the problems.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You know, there's been a lot of work in the last couple decades on how all of us have unconscious biases. How do those play into our attitudes toward inequality?
So I think I mentioned that before as well. Some of the chapters are actually written by not sociologists, but by a group of social psychologists, or actually more than one, I think. And they look at these sort of faulty ways in which we perceive things. And we are all biased in many ways. And I think that, you know, aside from the meritocracy loop that I told you, or the exposure, the difference between concrete exposure versus abstract exposure making a difference, I think we're also biased insofar as you can look at the intersectionalities of people who accept these inequalities. Yeah. And so if certain groups are more likely to accept them, and these certain groups have certain features, everything else being equal, it suggests that from their vantage point, there might be some, well, maybe biases or perceptions or omissions or abilities to see things that are different from other groups. Yeah. And that's for sure the case. And it very much depends on who you're talking. I think Megan earlier, when she was talking, was describing these hedge funds people. And in her chapter, she shows that, for example, most of them are, the most accepting ones are white and they're males. Though women also subscribe to the same logics of, well, I'm very wealthy, but I give money to charity. And that's a wonderful way of reducing inequalities. And it's important. It sure is. Men are more likely to think of those things. So those tell you not only who holds them, but perhaps the biases that might drive, that might inform them as they occupy those positions. The inaccuracies.
Bruce on Facebook writes, there will always be inequality. It's the gulf that separates the rich from the poor today, where much of our nation's laws only function to help worsen the inequality. I also remember a study from the early in the last decade that said 90% of Supreme Court decisions from the prior decade had gone the way the wealthy would want it to go. I think it was a Princeton study. So looking at how legal decisions and laws will reflect this acceptance of inequality.
Absolutely, 100%. And I think Megan's, for example, was talking about safety nets and those sorts of things. And sure, laws are another dimension of society where you can find reflections of our acceptance, encouragement, or non-acceptance of inequalities. One area that we don't have a chapter, I wish we did, is bankruptcy laws. So how do bankruptcy laws work? Are they forgiving? Is it easy to come out of bankruptcy easily without a stigma? In the United States, it's pretty easy to go. In fact, many think of it as a badge of honor. I went bankrupt twice, and here I am the third time, and I'm successful. I did the right thing, right? But I went bankrupt twice. No problem, no stigma. In other places, you go bankrupt once, and you're done. And the legal system never forgives you. So that's an example of how the legal system might encourage or discourage certain level of risk-taking or certain behaviors that might generate more or less inequality. So absolutely, I can probably think of a number of the fiscal code itself, taxation, Social Security benefits, choices, you know.
Protection of inheritance. But we only have about a minute left, Professor Duena, and I wanted to ask you what you hope that people come away with from reading the book, from listening to this discussion.
Well, I think a couple of things, perhaps. One, first of all, thanks to all the callers and the listeners, and thanks for having me here. One would be not to dismiss the logics of acceptance, not to throw them all out the window. I think many of them, if you read the chapters, have a logic to them, no pun intended, and the challenge is to understand when they make sense and when they don't make sense. So that's kind of a goal that we had in the volume, is to, what are these logics? What do they look like? Let's not pretend that they're silly. A lot of people believe in them, because if you don't understand them, you can't deal with them. So the second thing would be, if someone is interested in decreasing the extent of inequalities today, one way of doing so would be to go and examine these logics and challenge them to the degree that they are inaccurate or biased. And in the chapter towards the end, the last chapter, we do that.
Thank you so much. Francesco Duena teaches sociology at Bates College. He's the editor of the new book, The Social Acceptance of Inequality, on the Logics of a More Unequal World. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, a lifelong equestrian competitor and trainer joins us to discuss her new memoir about horses and the lessons that they teach us. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.